From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're now approaching George Bush's historic Annapolis conference, as it's called, on Israel-Palestine, so we can anticipate a flood of deceit and distortions to set the proper framework. And we should be prepared. We should be prepared to counter the propaganda assault, which has already begun.
As representatives of over 40 countries gather in Annapolis, Maryland, for a Middle East conference, we'll bring you two luminaries talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, world-renowned linguist and author Noam Chomsky, and Nobel Peace Laureate, former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
If you reject your calling, you may survive for a long time, but you will find it is all corrosive inside. And one day, you will implode.
Today, Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Noam Chomsky for the hour. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Leaders from around the world are gathering in Annapolis, Maryland today for a U.S.-sponsored summit on the Middle East. President Bush met separately with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas at the White House on Monday.
Thank you for working hard to implement a vision for a Palestinian state. We want to help you. We want there to be peace. We want the people in the Palestinian territories to have hope. And we thank you for your willingness to sit down with Israel to negotiate the settlement.
More than 40 organizations and countries, including Saudi Arabia and Syria, are attending. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports President Bush is expected to make no new or substantive proposals on the core issues at hand. In a speech today, Bush is expected to reaffirm his recognition of Israeli claims to major settlement blocks in the Palestinian West Bank. He is also expected to restate his position that Palestinian refugees who lost their homes in 1948 should only be allowed to resettle in a future Palestinian state. Iran and Hamas have been excluded from the meeting. On Monday, dismissed Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas denounced the talks as a sham.
The lawmakers of the Palestinian people today signed a document which stresses the commitment of the Palestinian people to their full rights and their commitment to the full rights of the nation on the Palestinian land and their rejection to any secessions that harm these rights.
At least four people were killed in Israel airstrikes in Gaza earlier today, including one civilian near a border crossing. The Bush administration has signed a new agreement with Iraq that could cement a long-term U.S. occupation. The new declaration of principles will steer future talks on U.S.-Iraqi ties. Officials plan to extend the U.N. mandate authorizing the U.S.-led occupation for another year. A long-term bilateral agreement on U.S. troop levels would follow. Iraqi officials told the Associated Press they foresee an enduring presence of around 50,000 U.S. troops. Under the proposed plan, U.S. forces would operate in permanent bases outside Iraqi cities. The Bush administration is no longer distancing itself from talk of a permanent occupation of Iraq. Deputy National Security Advisor Lieutenant General Douglas Lute said, quote, "The size and shape of any long-term presence in Iraq will be a key matter for negotiation between Iraq and the United States." Monday's agreement also calls for escalating U.S. influence in Iraq's economy. It calls, quote, for facilitating and encouraging the flow of foreign investments to Iraq, especially American investments, to contribute to reconstruction and rebuilding. Meanwhile, in Iraq, up to four Iraqi civilians have been killed in a U.S. military shooting in Baghdad. The victims were all bank employees riding in a minibus to work. Another five people were wounded. Iraq's interior ministry is being linked to the killing of 11 relatives of a prominent Iraqi journalist and critic of the Iraqi government. Colleagues say masked gunmen stormed the family home of Dia al-Khawaz, killing his sisters, their husbands, and children as they ate breakfast. Al-Khawaz's editor of the Asawat al-Iraq news agency. He was in Jordan at the time of the alleged murders. Reporters Without Borders says Iraqi police failed to intervene to stop the shooting. Friends say al-Khawaz has received several threats for his criticism of the U.S. occupation and Iraq's sectarian strife. On Monday, he called the attack, quote, a message to me and to any journalist inside Iraq or outside Iraq who opposes the policies of the Iraqi government. U.S. tensions with Russia are on the rise over accusations of vote meddling. On Monday, Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the Bush administration of trying to taint parliamentary elections set for next week. Putin says the U.S. influenced European monitors to cancel plans to observe the vote.
We have information that, once again, this was done on the recommendation of the U.S. State Department. We, of course, will take this into account in our interstate dealings, this is for sure. Actions such as these cannot wreck the elections in Russia. Their aim is to deprive the elections of legitimacy. That is absolutely clear. But they are not going to achieve that.
The U.S. State Department has denied Putin's charges. Putin's comments follow a weekend of protests of his government in several Russian cities. Hundreds of people were arrested. In France, unrest has again erupted in several Paris suburbs between youths and police. Hundreds of police officers fired tear gas and rubber bullets at crowds of teenagers on Monday. French officials say more than 70 officers and an unknown number of young people have been left injured. The demonstrators took to the streets after two young North African immigrants died in a police crash. The officers are under investigation for involuntary manslaughter amidst allegations they failed to seek medical help for the young victims. The clashes come 2 years after a three-week youth uprising prompted by the deaths of two teens electrocuted as they hid from police. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi has announced he will step down next month. Lott says he plans to pursue a career in the private sector. His year-end resignation means he'll avoid an incoming law forcing senators wanting to become paid Capitol Hill lobbyists to wait 2 years instead of one. Lott has resisted pressure to leave office since December 2002 when he praised the 1948 pro-segregation presidential campaign of Senator Strom Thurmond.
I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
Senator Lott was speaking at Thurmond's 100th birthday party. And former Vice President Al Gore was back at the White House Monday for a ceremony honoring this year's Nobel Prize winners. Gore shared the Nobel Peace Prize with the UN's Intergovernmental Campaign on Climate Change for his work on global warming. Gore met with President Bush for over half an hour before the ceremony. It was their first private meeting since December 2000, when Bush was declared the winner in their presidential race, despite losing the popular vote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Leaders from around the world are gathering in Annapolis, Maryland today to take part in a U.S.-sponsored summit on the Middle East. President Bush met separately with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas at the White House Monday. More than 40 organizations and countries, including Saudi Arabia and Syria, are attending the conference today. Hamas was not invited. A final agenda has not yet been drawn up, but a draft of a joint document was leaked to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. It makes no mention of the situation in Gaza or of core issues like the status of Jerusalem, settlements, borders, the separation wall, and Palestinian refugees. Today we spend the hour on the Israel-Palestine conflict with two of the world's leading thinkers, former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu and world-renowned linguist and author Noam Chomsky. They recently spoke at a conference in Boston sponsored by Sabeel, a Palestinian Christian organization. The conference was called the Apartheid Paradigm in Palestine-Israel, highlighting issues of justice and equality. We begin today with Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for over half a century. Chomsky is the author of dozens of books on U.S. foreign policy. His most recent is called Failed States, The Abuse of Power and the Assault on Democracy. Noam Chomsky spoke before a packed audience at Boston's historic Old South Church.
Personal discomfort, because anything I say will be abstract and dry and restrained. The crimes against Palestinians in the occupied territories and elsewhere, particularly Lebanon, are so shocking that the only emotionally valid reaction is rage and call for extreme actions. But that does not help the victims. And in fact, it's likely to harm them. We have to face the reality that our actions have consequences and they have to be adapted to real-world circumstances, difficult as it may be to stay calm in the face of shameful crimes in which we are directly and crucially implicated. Well, I've been asked to talk about the apartheid paradigm and the proper response here, so I'll do that, though not without some additional reservations. We have to recognize that there will be no clear answer as to the question of whether the apartheid paradigm applies in Israel or in Boston right here or elsewhere. The genre has, after all, only one example, South Africa. And there are similarities elsewhere in many dimensions, and it's fair enough to bring them up, but there's very little point debating whether they are close enough in one or another case to count as apartheid, because that will never be settled. We know that in advance. I've brought up similarities in the past when I thought that they were appropriate. Actually, the one time I recall clearly was exactly 10 years ago. That was at a conference at Ben-Gurion University in Beersheba. It was on the anniversary of the 30th year of the military occupation. And in the talk there, I quoted from a standard history of South Africa on elections in the Bantustans, which I'll read and just change a few words and you'll know what it's about. South African retention of effective power through its officials in the Bantustans, its overwhelming economic influence and security arrangements gave to this initiative of elections elements of a farce. However, unlikely candidates as were the Bantustans for any meaningful independent existence, their expanding bureaucracies provided jobs for new strata of educated Africans tied to the system in a new way, and a basis for accumulation for a small number of Africans with access to loans and political influence. Repression, too, could be indigenized through developing homeland policy and army personnel. On the fringe of the Bantustans, border industry growth centers were planned as a means of freeing capital from some of the restraints imposed on industrial expansion elsewhere, and to take advantage of virtually captive and particularly cheap labor. Within the homelands, economic development was more a matter of advertising brochures than actual practical activity, though some officials in South Africa understood the needs from their own perspective for some kind of revitalization of the homelands, to prevent their economies from collapsing even further. Well, I won't waste time expressing the similarities to the occupied territories, but you can do that quite easily. 10 years ago, that was the optimistic prospect for the occupied territories. By now, even that's remote, and reality is far more grim than it was then. There's no time, and I presume no need to review the harrowing details. We're now approaching George Bush's historic Annapolis conference, as it's called, on Israel-Palestine, so we can anticipate a flood of deceit and distortions to set the proper framework. And we should be prepared. We should be prepared to counter the propaganda assault, which has already begun. Just to pick a couple of examples, Bostonians could read in the Boston Globe a few days ago that at the Tabak conference in January 2001, now quoting, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak accepted ideas floated by President Bill Clinton that would have produced a Palestinian state in 97% of the West Bank and 100% of Gaza. But these forthcoming gestures failed. The evil Palestinians refused Israel's generous offers, keeping to their time-honored insistence on seizing defeat from the jaws of victory and proving that they're not partners for negotiation. Well, there's one fragment of truth in this conventional fabrication. There was a conference in Taba. And in fact, it did come close to a possible settlement, but the rest is pure invention. In particular, the conference was terminated abruptly by Prime Minister Barak. The truth is completely unacceptable, so the facts are either suppressed, as they generally are, or, as in this case, just inverted. And we can expect a good deal more of it. Actually, the truth about the Taba conference merits attention. That week, in one week in January 2001, was the one moment in 30 years when the United States and Israel abandoned the rejectionist stance that they've maintained in virtual isolation until the present. And that may suggest some thoughts about another familiar fairy tale that you could read about a couple of days earlier in the New York Times, where the respected policy analyst and former high government official, Leslie Gelb, wrote that every U.S. administration since 1967 has privately favored returning almost all of the territory to the Palestinians for the purposes of creating a separate Palestinian state. Note the word privately, crucial. We know what the administrations have said publicly. Publicly, they have rejected adamantly anything remotely of the sort ever since 1976, when the United States vetoed a Security Council resolution calling for a two-state settlement on the international border, incorporating all the relevant wording of UN 242, it's the basic diplomatic document to which Washington appeals when it's convenient. A U.S. veto, it's worth bearing in mind, is a double veto. One part of the veto is that the actions are barred, of course. And it's also vetoed from history, as in this case. So you'll work really hard to find it, even in the scholarly literature.
We'll come back to Professor Noam Chomsky's address in Boston, and then we'll go on to South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu. They were both speaking at the Sibiel conference. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Thank you.
Jimi Hendrix playing at Woodstock in 1969. He would have been 65 years old today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky speaking recently in Boston at the Old South Church at a conference called The Apartheid Paradigm in Palestine, Israel.
Sometimes the public rejection of a separate Palestinian state is more articulate and considerably more extreme. So take, say, George Bush, number one, who is reputed to be the most hostile to Israel of U.S. presidents. In 1988, as you know, the Palestinian National Council formally accepted a two-state settlement, and the Israeli government responded. This was the coalition government of Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Shamir. They responded by issuing a formal declaration that there can be no additional Palestinian state between Jordan and Palestine. Additional because for Shimon Peres and his labor coalition, Jordan already was a Palestinian state. It's a view that's attributed to the right wing, but that's mistaken. This is Shimon Peres. The United States reacted to that with what was called the Baker Plan. James Baker, Secretary of State. The Bush-Baker Plan endorsed Israel's position without qualification and went on to add that any Palestinian negotiators would have to accept that framework, namely no second Palestinian state in addition to Jordan. That's Bush number one, the alleged critic of Israel, and the respected diplomat James Baker. Again, the truth is inconvenient, so virtually none of this was reported, and you'll have to search hard to extricate it from the web of self-serving propaganda that dominates commentary and reporting, of which Leslie Gelb's article in the New York Times is a typical but not unusual example. Well, I'm not going to go on with that, but the diplomatic record is one of uniform rejectionism, apart from the week in Taba, and unilateral rejectionism, increasingly so. By now, virtually the entire world agrees on the two-state international consensus of the past 30 years, pretty much along the lines that were almost agreed upon at Taba. That includes all the Arab states who actually go beyond to call for full normalization of relations with Israel. It includes Iran, although you won't find that published here, which accepts the Arab League position. It includes Hamas. Its leaders have repeatedly endorsed, called for a two-state settlement, even in articles in the U.S. press. That also includes Hamas's most militant figure, Kamal Mishal, who's in exile in Syria, and it includes the rest of the world. Israel rejects it, and the United States backs that rejection fully, not in words just, but in actions. Bush number two has gone to new extremes in rejectionism. He's declared the illegal West Bank settlements they must remain part of Israel. That's in accord with the Clinton position expressed by his negotiator, Dennis Ross, who explained that what he called Israel's needs take precedence over Palestinian wants. That's Clinton. But the party line remains undisturbed. Facts don't matter. Bush, Rice, and the rest are yearning to realize Bush's vision of a Palestinian state somewhere, someplace, persisting in the noble endeavor of the longtime honest broker. What's happened in the past is, of course, rejectionism goes far beyond words. It includes settlement programs, the annexation wall closers, checkpoints, and so on. All settlements increased steadily right through the Oslo years, peaking, actually, in Clinton's last year, the year 2000, right before the Camp David Accords. And the story is now being repeated before our eyes. Shouldn't surprise us. So to take just one example, with the Annapolis conference approaching, Israel has just confiscated more Arab land to build a bypass road from Palestinians, I'm quoting now, in order to push the Palestinian traffic between Bethlehem and Ramallah deep into the desert and effectively bar Palestinians from the central part of the West Bank. That's part of the so-called E1 project, which is designed to incorporate the town of Ma'ale Adumim within Israel and effectively to bisect the West Bank. With such policies, continuing to quote, with such policies enacted by the government, the famous Annapolis Conference is emptied of all meaning long before it convenes. This is quotes from the Israeli peace organization Gush Shalom. All of this is backed by the honest brokers in Washington and paid for by U.S. taxpayers, who incidentally overwhelmingly join the international consensus in opposition to their own government. But that's not what we're going to hear. Well, in fairness, it should be added that there is occasional public criticism of the settlement programs. So in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, there was a favorable review of a very important study, which has just been translated into English, Lords of the Land, by Edith Zertal and Akiva Eldar, which bitterly condemns the U.S.-backed Israeli programs in the West Bank and the takeover of Israeli political life by their advocates. It's a strong and important book. The review, however, goes on with conventional fairy tales. Among them, it tells us that within the Green Line in Israel itself, Israel is what calls a vibrant democracy in which non-Jews have equal rights, and unlike the West Bank, there are no Arab villages made inaccessible because their roads have been dug up by army bulldozers. Well, again, there's a fragment of truth in the description. So take, for example, the village Dar el-Hanun in the so-called Triangle, Wadi Ara. It's older than the State of Israel, but it's one of the innumerable unrecognized villages in Israel. So it's true that there's no road dug up by bulldozers. And the reason is that there's no road. No road is permitted by the state authorities. No construction is permitted. No services are provided. That's not an unusual situation for Palestinian citizens, who are also effectively barred from over 90% of the land by a complex and intricate web of laws and administrative arrangements. Technically, that was overruled by the High Court 7 years ago, but as far as I can determine, only technically. And we may recall that in the United States, it took over a century for even formal implementation of the 14th Amendment, guaranteeing equal rights to all persons, and actual implementation of it is still remote, a century and a half later. Well, let's turn briefly to the important question, the most important question, what can we do about it? Here it's useful to think about the apartheid analogy, and it's useful to remember a little history. In 1963, the UN Security Council declared a voluntary arms embargo on South Africa that was extended to a mandatory embargo in 1977. And that was followed by economic sanctions and other measures, sometimes officials, countries, cities, towns, some organized by popular movements. Now, not all countries participated. In the United States, the U.S. Congress did impose sanctions over Reagan's veto, but U.S. trade with South Africa then increased by various evasions, along with concealed support for South African terrorist atrocities in Mozambique and Angola, which took a horrendous toll. It's about 1.5 million killed and over $60 billion in damage during the Reagan years of constructive engagement, according to a UN analysis. In 1988, the Reagan administration declared Mandela's African National Congress to be one of the world's most notorious terrorist groups. 1988. while it described RENAMO in Mozambique merely as an indigenous insurgent group. That was after it had just killed about 100,000 people, according to the State Department, with, of course, U.S.-backed African support. Thatcher's record was similar or maybe worse, but most of this was in secret. There was just too much popular opposition. And the popular opposition made a difference. There was a very significant anti-apartheid movement decades after the global decision at the Security Council to bring apartheid to an end. In 1965, boycotts and other measures would not have been effective. 20 years later, they were effective, but that was after the groundwork had been laid by activist, educational, and organizing efforts, including within the powerful states, which is what matters in an ugly world. Well, in the case of Israel-Palestine, the groundwork has not been laid. The quotes that I just gave are perfectly representative examples. You can fill them out in books. The kind of popular measures that were effective against apartheid by the late 1980s are not only ineffective in the case of Israel-Palestine today, but in fact sometimes backfire, harming the victims. We've seen that over and over. It's going to continue until the organizing and educational efforts make real progress. It's not just the United States. The European Union is hardly different. So, for example, the European Union does not bar arms deliveries to Israel. It joined the United States in vicious punishment of Palestinians because they committed the grave crime of voting the wrong way in a free election. And there was very little internal protest in Europe. Populations support the international consensus, but they don't react when their governments undermine any hope for its realization. Well, in the coming weeks and the longer term, there's plenty of educational and organizational activity that will have to be carried out among an American population that happens to be largely receptive, though deluged with propaganda and deceit. And it's not going to be easy. It's never been easy. But much harder tasks have been accomplished with dedicated and persistent effort.
MIT professor Noam Chomsky speaking recently in Boston at a conference called The Apartheid Paradigm in Palestine-Israel, sponsored by the Palestinian Christian organization Sabeel. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. The keynote speaker at the conference was the former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He was an inspirational leader in the South African fight against apartheid, awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984, today continuing to speak out around the globe for peace and justice. In 2006, the Israeli government blocked Tutu from leading a UN delegation into Gaza. He was investigating the killing of 19 Palestinians in Gaza. Tutu made headlines recently when the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, canceled an invitation for him to speak at the school next spring. The president of the university, the Reverend Dennis Deese, revoked the invitation over Tutu's criticism of Israeli policy in the occupied territories. Deese also fired Chris Tofolo as head of the university's Peace and Justice program, though she remains a professor at the university. She had supported the invitation to Tutu. After a vocal public outcry from students and faculty, Deese apologized to Tutu and invited him back to speak at the university. Tutu began his speech at the historic Old South Church in Boston by addressing the issue.
As you probably know, someone put out a rather distorted version of what I said here in 2002, and on the basis of that, the president of St. Thomas University decided I shouldn't visit his campus. It is good that he has since reversed this decision, and I want to commend him very warmly for his courage in admitting publicly that he was wrong. It is never easy to do that. I have received the president's invitation in which he makes a very handsome apology, which I have accepted. And I am happy to accept his invitation, provided it can be fitted into my schedule, and if Professor Toffolo is reinstated with... with no adverse comments in her academic file arising from this unfortunate episode. I thank God for my Hebrew antecedents. I thank God that I too am a descendant of Abraham. I give thanks to God for the gift of the Holy Scriptures, made up substantially of the Hebrew Scriptures, forming what we conventionally refer to as our Old Testament. Even our New Testament, which would be distinctively Christian, is incomprehensible without taking its Jewish setting seriously. For instance, the name Jesus is Greek for Joshua, the one who led God's people into the promised land. And the word Christ is anointed one in Hebrew, Messiah, whose coming was predicted in the Jewish scriptures and was longed for so poignantly by the Jews. I tell you nothing you do not already know. I refer to it only to assert that spiritually I am of Hebrew descent. That legacy has been of crucial importance for me in our struggle against apartheid. At the height of the struggle, when apartheid's repression was at its most vicious, and it seemed indeed as if the apartheid rulers were firmly ensconced in power, when they had all but knocked out the stuffing of their opponents, and they were strutting the stage as invincible cocks of the walk, then we turned to the inspiration of our Hebrew tradition and antecedents. We were able to revive and sustain our people's hope for their vindication and the ultimate triumph of good over evil, of freedom over injustice and oppression, by our references to our biblical traditions. It was often quite exhilarating. I remember once when there had been a massacre in one of our townships, which had been instigated by a sinister third force linked to the apartheid security apparatus. Our bishops, quite unusually, suspended a session of Episcopal Synod so that, as in the case of an Ezekiel who sat side by side with stunned exiles, so we would be a ministry of presence. And we held a service in one of our ghetto township churches. The people were stunned, devastated by the naked violence of that massacre. I preached, and I used Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 9, God's words which Yahweh asked Moses to announce to the children of Israel. And I said to our people gathered there, our God is not deaf. Our God has heard our cries. Our God is not stupid. Our God knows our suffering. Our God is not blind. God has seen and sees our pain and anguish. And yes, our God will come down and set us free. Yes, our God will come down to open the prison doors and lead our leaders from prison and lead our leaders back from exile. For we had learned from our Jewish tradition that God, our God, is notoriously biased, forever taking the side of the weak, the oppressed, the downtrodden, against the kings and the powerful oppressors. Our God had been met first in the Bible story, not in a sanctuary. Our God was met first in the mundane world of politics. Our God taking the side of a rebel of slaves against the mighty Pharaoh. God, we said to our people, is not neutral. God sided with Uriah the Hittite against his own favorite, King David, after David's adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. Thou art the man. Anywhere else, the king could have got away with both actions, but not in Israel. It really seemed as if the Jewish scriptures were written specifically for us. The story of Naboth's vineyard and King Ahab and Jezebel being confronted on Yahweh's behalf by Elijah seemed to have been written especially with our situation in mind, where blacks, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly, were shipped in their millions like so many pawns in population removal schemes and dumped in poverty-stricken Bantustan homelands, hardly able to eke out a living, cut off from the more affluent so-called white South Africa.
Former South African Archbishop, Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu, giving a speech at the Old South Church in Boston. We'll return to the conclusion of his address in a minute. Lebanese musician Marcel Khalifa, the song Rita and the Rifle. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. As we return to the conclusion of the address of the former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who's speaking at the Old South Church in Boston, speaking at a conference sponsored by the Palestinian Christian organization Sabil. Nobel Peace Laureate Tutu spoke about his struggle against the apartheid government in South Africa as a religious leader.
It was exhilarating, preaching to the oppressed and downtrodden. The well-to-do, the powerful, often complained that we were mixing religion with politics, and we would declare that we're doing no more, in fact, than just preaching the gospel. That they had brought us the Bible from wherever, and we were taking it seriously. We would be accused of being political, and I often retorted, I don't know which Bible you are reading. I must say, I've never heard the poor complain, Bishop Tutu, now you are being political. If anything, they would possibly have said, you are not political enough. And God vindicated us. Apartheid rulers beat the dust, as all oppressors have done always. For this is a moral universe, right and wrong matter. It cannot happen that evil, injustice, and oppression can have the last word. No, ultimately, goodness, justice, freedom, these will prevail. What is this to the point? Now, I could have spent a great deal of time rehearsing what we all know, how I experienced a deja vu when I saw a security checkpoint which Palestinians had to negotiate most of their lives, that I was reminded so painfully of the same checkpoints in apartheid South Africa, when arrogant white policemen treated almost all blacks like dirt, or when someone pointed to a house in Jerusalem and said, that used to be our home, but now it has been taken over by the Israelis, which would make me recall so painfully similar statements in Cape Town by coloreds who had been thrown out of their homes and relocated in ghetto townships some distance from the town center. I could have bemoaned the illegal wall that has encroached on Palestinian land, separated families, divided property, and made what used to be a short walk to school turn into an expensive nightmare voyage, running the gauntlet of checkpoints, etc., etc. I could have said there were things that even you didn't find even in apartheid South Africa, that we had things that you didn't see in an apartheid South Africa, such as collective punishment. I have not gone that route. I have not gone that route. No, I have chosen a different approach. My address is really a cri de coeur, a cry of anguish from the depth of my heart, an impassioned plea to my spiritual relatives, the offspring of Abraham like me. Please, please hear the call, the noble call of your scriptures, of our scriptures, to be with the God of the Exodus, who took the side of a bunch of slaves against the powerful Pharaoh. Be on the side of the God who intervened through his prophet Elijah on behalf of Naboth. Hear the plea of your scriptures and stand with the God who intervened through his prophet Nathan on behalf of Uriah against King David. Be on the side of the God who revealed a soft spot in his heart for the widow, the orphan, and the alien. Be on the side of the God whose spirit sends us out to preach good news to the poor. Don't be found fighting against this God, your God,
our God, the God who hears the cry of the oppressed, the God who sees their anguish, the God who will always come down to deliver them. Be not opposed to the God whose spirit, when it anoints you, makes you concerned for the poor. This is your calling. If you disobey that calling, if you do not heed it, then as sure as anything, one day you will come a cropper. You will probably not succumb to an outside assault militarily. With the unquestioning support of the United States of America, you are probably impregnable. But you who are called, are they who are called, asked to deal with the oppressed, the weak, the despised, compassionately, caringly, remembering what happened to you in Egypt, and much more recently in Germany. Remember and act appropriately. If you reject your calling, you may survive for a long time, but you will find it is all corrosive inside. And one day, you will implode. A recent report by a clinical psychologist who was herself a soldier in the Israeli Defense Force, Nofan Yeshai Katrim, at the Hebrew University, speaks of how Israeli soldiers were gratuitously cruel and carried out acts of brutality to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. One of the soldiers, she said, told her how a new commander went out with them on patrol because of curfew. There were no Palestinians in sight except a four-year-old boy who was playing with the sand in the backyard of his home. This commander went and broke the arm of this four-year-old. And another soldier told of how, whilst they were on patrol, they encountered one Palestinian. And quite unprovoked, one of the soldiers shot him in the stomach, and they left him writhing on the ground, dying, as they drove off. When you uphold an unjust dispensation, it corrodes your humanity. In South Africa, a former cabinet minister in the apartheid dispensation showed this when he was told of the death of Steve Biko in detention. Jimmy Kruger said it left him cold. Thanks be to God for the many, many Jews who know what their divine calling is and want the Israeli government to live it out. We believe in a two-state solution of two sovereign, viable states
each with contiguous borders guaranteed as secure by the international community. We condemn all acts of terrorism by whoever they are committed. The suicide bomber has to be condemned for targeting innocent civilians. But equally, the Israelis are to be condemned for their acts of indiscriminate reprisal that too target innocent civilians. We say, please learn at least one positive lesson from apartheid South Africa. Under Mr. F.W. de Klerk, who must be commended for his outstanding courage, the apartheid rulers decided to negotiate. To negotiate not with those they liked, but with their sworn enemy. And they found the security that had eluded them for so long and that had caused so much suffering and bloodshed. It came not from the barrel of a gun. No, it came when the legitimate aspirations and human rights of all were recognized and respected. That was 13 years ago, and the peace is still holding. Many had predicted that South Africa would be overwhelmed by a catastrophic racial bloodbath. It did not happen. It did not happen because they negotiated in good faith with their enemies. Somebody has said, if something has happened once, then clearly it is something possible. It happened in South Africa. Why not in the Middle East? The world needs the Jews, Jews who are faithful to their vocation that has meant so much for the world's morality, for its sense of what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, what is just and unjust, what is oppressive and what sets people free. Jews are indispensable for a good, compassionate, just, and caring world. And so are Palestinians. Thank you.
Former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, speaking recently at the Old South Church in Boston, along with Noam Chomsky and others, at a conference sponsored by the Palestinian Christian organization Sabil. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. The transcripts will also be available there, as well as the video and audio podcasts. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Belkadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Kizzy Cox, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley and Hugh Grant and Samantha Chambly, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Laura Chipley, and Vesta Godars. Again, our website, democracynow.org. Special belated happy birthday to Samantha Chambly as she says goodbye to her 20s. On December 15th, I'll be at the Washington Convention Center celebrating 30th anniversary of WPFW. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.